From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Many guns in the U.S. are purchased by women.
The demand is greater, and because of that, we have stepped up our standards. We don't have to settle for something that is tactical or ugly or cheap, and we're not willing to compromise fashion for function.
That's Leslie Dietz, founder and CEO of Concealed Carry, that's C-A-R-R-I-E. Ahead this hour, we'll talk about fashion for the pistol-packing female. First, though, last week we talked about the federal immigration program known as 287G. It asks local law enforcement agencies to check immigration status when they arrest someone. We heard from Azadeh Shashahani of the Atlanta-based social justice group Project South.
Back in the day, because they weren't considered priorities for deportation, they had a clean criminal record, they had a strong ties to the community, they were allowed to live and work in the U.S. and be with their families, and that just is not the case anymore.
Shashahani says people detained but not deported under this program during the Obama administration may now be forced to leave the country. Here are your first thoughts. Ethan Vuley from Atlanta leaves us this message.
You know, if anything, I want less immigration enforcement in my community. I work in restaurants as well as insurance. Many of my insureds are tax-paying Hispanics who are not even allowed to technically have a license, but they're allowed to buy insurance.
We always love to get your thoughts. You can call us, like Ethan did, at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. There are clear racial inequalities in our criminal justice system, but the causes of those inequities is not quite as clear. A new book explores the complexities of that. It's called Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. James Forman Jr. is a professor of law at Yale Law School. His father was a leader of SNCC, that's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And James Jr. is a graduate of Atlanta's own Roosevelt High. He joins us in studio, and he'll speak at a Morehouse College conference later this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with your dad. One of the stories that he repeated often was after he got after he left the Air Force, he was pulled over. He was studying. He was going to USC at the time, I think. He was studying late. He was pulled over by police because there had been a robbery, and they said he was suspicious. He was apprehended anyway, arrested, I think. And he described that event as being so dramatic and traumatic, he had to seek therapy for it. And I wonder how much of your dad's experience ended up in your research for this book.
Well, I think a lot of it. I mean, his life, right? Your parents, they pass on their messages. They pass on their stories at the dinner table. And in one way, growing up in Atlanta, I had the benefit, and my generation had the benefit of the successes of his generation because, you know, we didn't necessarily have to deal with an all-white police force like the sort that he had to deal with growing up in Los Angeles. And we had opportunities, right? That generation, the civil rights generation, they made it possible for people of my generation to have access to jobs that were, you know, impossible to imagine to a black man of my dad's generation. But at the same time, I could still see a lot of those perpetuation of those policing practices that he had described. It's just that now it was more complicated because now we had a lot of African American officers, right? And growing up in Atlanta, we had a black police chief, we had a black mayor. But at the same time, there was a lot of really kind of damaging practices. And a lot of kids in my neighborhood grew up, you know, fearing the police. And so that's, I guess, some
both
of the complexity.
Both black and white.
Both black and white. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the issues of once upon a time, we thought in this country that if we integrated the police departments, that would change policing practices. Martin Luther King Sr. gave a speech at Morehouse College in 1941 when there were no black officers in Atlanta. And he said, 105,000 Negroes deserve one Negro police. And the belief was that when the force was integrated, that the practices would change in poor communities and black communities. And what we saw was we got the integration, which was great, which we need, which we deserve, but a lot of the practices continue.
And you actually start the book with a story of a judge, an actual African-American judge, lecturing a kid that you were defending about how he has just basically trashed the entire legacy of the civil rights movement. That event seemed to have made a huge impression upon you. Why?
Well, so Brandon had pled guilty to possession of a gun and possession of a small amount of marijuana. He was facing sentencing in, as you said, with an African-American judge, and I was asking for him to be put on probation. And the judge not only didn't do that, the judge locked him up, but on the way to locking him up, he gave him this speech where he said, listen, Martin Luther King fought and died for your freedom. He fought and died for change in America, and his fight was not for you to be running and gunning and thugging and carrying on and carrying that gun. And so for me, somebody who had become a public defender because I viewed it as the civil rights issue of my generation, I viewed myself as carrying on my father's legacy, to go into court and have, you know, a black man representing a black client in front of a black judge and have that judge flip that civil rights history on its head and use it as a justification to lock up my client, I found incredibly demoralizing.
So I want to be clear to anyone who's listening that your book in no way claims that institutional racism is not a great deal at fault for their incarceration crisis in the United States, right?
That's absolutely right, and I'm glad you brought that up. No, I'm very clear throughout the book that structural and institutional racism has limited the options that were available to the African-American decision makers that I write about, right? I'm writing mainly about black police chiefs, black mayors, black judges, black police officers. But we don't operate in a vacuum, right? They operate within a structure. And so you see over and over again the way that racism limits their choices. They say, black decision makers say, we want more police and we want more prosecutors. But we also want more jobs. We want more money for education. We want money for housing. We want national gun control. We want a Marshall Plan for urban America. We want the United States to invest in black communities the way it invested in Europe after World War II. But black leaders get none of that. For 50 years, they go to Congress asking for money for all of the above, and they come back for 50 years with money for one of the above, and the one of the above is law enforcement.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with James Forman Jr., a law school professor at Yale and author of Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And Professor Forman speaks at Morehouse College later this morning. So let's go back to the war on crime. And there are certain eras in law enforcement trends, I guess. The war on crime was one of them. Broken windows policy was another one. And you are very careful about tracing, about talking about the majority African-American communities who also were part enthusiastic partners in the war on crime. Why?
Folks were desperate. Folks were scared. People wanted protection. So the homicide rate in this country doubled in the 1960s. It tripled in D.C. It more than doubled in Atlanta. And then in the 80s, in the early 90s, we get the crack epidemic, right? Which a lot of black leaders said, this is the worst thing to hit us since slavery. So when you have mothers who say, I can't take my kid to school because they're drug dealers on the corner, and I can't leave them in the park after school because they're selling drugs in the park and they're shooting in the park and I'm scared. And you have those folks reaching out to their elected officials, African-American elected officials in many cases in some of our big cities, and saying, we want protection. The response from the elected officials, people like Maynard Jackson here in Atlanta in the 1970s and 1980s, is to try to provide that protection. And they do it the only way they can, or the only way they know how, with their sort of limited imagination that we as Americans have about how to respond to crime. And that's through more aggressive policing. So the need for policing, right, the need for protection is present. It's just that the way we went about it was so damaging and so kind of over-aggressive that it's led to this thing that we now talk about as mass incarceration.
So one of the things I enjoy is that your book doesn't just tell us what all these problems are, but you have solutions for them. And a lot of them come from your years spent as a public defender in D.C. Give me an example of something that might make a change.
Well, the number one most important thing that we can do is economic, and it's jobs. And so I always tell when I'm talking to a mayor, I'm talking to a governor, and they're talking about, well, we have a crime crisis in this particular community. And I say, and I'm saying this not facetiously, I say, instead of saturation policing, what if we tried saturation employment? What if we actually put everybody, business leaders, other people, community leaders, government leaders together, and we said, in this neighborhood, for the next 2 years, we are going to make it our goal to make sure that every single person in this neighborhood has a job. Like, let's actually try that as a solution. So that's one thing that we can do. We can also do things like there are new programs that are alternatives to violence. Instead of just locking people up for long sentences, there's restorative justice, where you bring members of the community together, people that have been harmed and people that have harmed them. There's a program out of Brooklyn called Common Justice, which does this beautifully. And people sit down around a table and they talk about their shared pain. The person that committed the crime apologizes and they talk about the forces that helped drive them to it. And the person that was harmed gets not just prison sentence, not prison for the person that did it, but they actually get treatment, and they themselves, right, get trauma treatment. A lot of people that are victims of crime, the number one thing they want is they want somebody to address their trauma. And right now we don't do any of that. We just say prison for the perpetrator and everybody go home, as if that's supposed to solve the matter, and it doesn't.
So, you know, we had the beginnings of justice reform a few years ago, and some of that has been rolled back in recent years. What do you tell to lawmakers who at this very moment are probably considering some of these reforms and whether or not to move forward?
Well, it's been rolled back at the federal level, but what I always want to talk to people about is that 88% of prisoners in this country are in state, local, and county prisons, and 85% of law enforcement is state and local. So the federal government actually is a tiny part of the overall picture. And we've seen that in the last year, even as President Trump and Jeff Sessions, as you say, have kind of stepped back from the reform movement. In Louisiana, they just passed a massive overhaul of their criminal justice system that's going to make it much less punitive, and it's incredibly punitive. In Alabama, they just restored rights to citizens. Many citizens that have lost their right to vote had it restored, and that was 3 months ago. In Philadelphia, just last week, a very progressive, reform-oriented prosecutor who said, I'm not going to keep fighting the war on drugs, and I'm not going to seek the death penalty, and I'm not going to lock people up on unaffordable cash bail. He ran for the top prosecutor in the city. People thought it was a joke when he first announced, because his main background was suing police officers, and he won. So what I tell people is keep the focus on the local level. That's where we're going to continue to win the battle. And then eventually, hopefully, there'll be a change in the administration in D.C. and we can start to fight there.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but there has been some pushback on your book from people saying, why are you blaming the victims for what's happening with an African-American community?
Well, I don't think I am blaming the victims. In fact, I think in some ways my book shows how deeply entrenched structural and institutional racism have become in this country, that they have led us all in some ways to become more punitive. They've led us all in some ways to contribute to this. So my message to people is nobody is blameless. We all played a part.
That is Yale Law School Professor James Forman Jr. His book is called Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. It hit shelves in April, and James is speaking at Morehouse College a little later this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we hear music from Atlanta cellist Takanobu. First, though, look into the toxic world of coal ash that may be leaking into water. This is on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Women are a driving force behind new gun sales, and women are designing products to make it easier and more fashionable to carry concealed firearms. GPB's Leah Fleming brings us this report from a meeting of the Lady Sharpshooters in Atlanta.
On a Tuesday night at Sharpshooters USA, a group of about six women in pink T-shirts that say Lady Sharpshooters across the back are lined up in stalls next to one another. The smell of perfume mixes with gunpowder.
Oh!
Cassie Weiderman is one of the lady sharpshooters. She came straight from work on this weeknight, dressed conservatively in form-fitting slacks and a sweater. Tonight, she's shooting her Glock 42. She conceal and carries, too.
I carry appendix carry with an inside-the-waistband holster. Usually I can wear it. I've worn it with these pants before and then just like a tunic, a flowy top, or a pattern top.
The way a woman conceal and carries is as varied as her choice of handbags and shoes. For example, Weiderman says she does not like to carry in her purse because she doesn't always have one.
All leather, crocodile printed. This has a little magnetic closure here. They all have a built-in self-defense compartment.
At the front of the store is a large section of accessories with lots of pink packaging and luxury handbags and wristlets. The bags are the vision of Leslie Dietz, founder and CEO of Concealed Carry. Carry is spelled just like Carrie Bradshaw, a character from the wildly popular HBO drama Sex and the City. Dietz named her Concealed Carry line after that Carrie. Why? Because of her fabulous style, of course.
Aren't these cute? These are little compacts. They have a wristlet if you want to carry it by that, or we also have little crossbody chains you can thread up through the spine. Comes with a little tassel. That's your wristlet. They all have a tassel and a little key fob.
That cute little number retails at just under $300. Dietz says she started owning a gun about 18 years ago. At that time, she didn't want to carry on her because there's no place on her that she can carry comfortably. She's slender, about 5'3", and just over 100 pounds. She says in the past, the problem was that the products available to women were designed by male-dominated companies.
So you had a man designing a handbag, which is usually, unless you're maybe Ralph Lauren, not a good idea.
Dietz says women like her are savvier today than ever before when it comes to their firearms and their fashion.
The demand is greater, and because of that, we have stepped up our standards. We don't have to settle for something that is tactical or ugly or cheap, and we're not willing to compromise fashion for function.
And her growing business is reflecting that. Dietz says when she started 3 years ago, she started with just 4 products. She's up to 30 now. Over the last 3 years, several women-owned companies have cropped up, offering products like bras with holsters, lacy shapewear that allows a woman to conceal a gun without losing her silhouette, and compression underwear.
That was GPB's Leah Fleming reporting. To hear all of our recent stories about gun ownership in Georgia, visit gpbnews.org. When coal is burned, it leaves behind ash, and that ash is quite toxic. For decades, it was haphazardly dumped into rivers and ponds. But within the last 10 years or so, there's been a push to clean up the way coal ash is disposed of. Georgia Power has vowed to close all of its dump ponds, but many feel just closing those ponds opens up a whole new slew of environmental issues. Joining me now is Chris Bowers, senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center, and also Jen Hilburn, who's head riverkeeper for the Altamaha Riverkeeper Group. That's a grassroots organization dedicated to the protection of Georgia's biggest river. Thanks so much to both of you for joining me.
Good morning.
Thank you.
I want to say that we were not able to get somebody from Georgia Power, but we did get a statement from them. So first, let's hear from John Kraft, who's a media spokesperson for Georgia Power. He's talking about the company's plan to drain their ash ponds.
Georgia Power has safely managed and responsibly managed all of our ash ponds and power production facilities over the decades, and that will not change as we go through this closure process, this transition process with our ash ponds. We announced a year or so ago that we're going to permanently close all 29 of our ash ponds at 11 different coal-fired power plants across the state.
Now, Chris, you've even pointed to the McManus site, for example, that you feel Georgia Power handled well. What are you concerned about as this push to close these ponds goes forward?
Well, we are on the going well part. We do agree that Georgia Power is doing a lot of things correctly. So they're taking a lot of the sites, the ponds that are directly adjacent to the rivers and lakes, they're removing those and completely excavating that waste. that's EPA has recognized based on detailed studies contains a lot of toxic pollutants such as arsenic and selenium, chromium, beryllium, things you do not want in your groundwater. You do not want seeping into your rivers and lakes. And so we agree that they are doing a good job with the 17 ponds and the 10 million tons of these open waste pits that are sitting right next to our rivers, lakes, and streams. What we have concerns about is that they're planning to leave in place the majority, about 80 million tons, in place right on these waterfront sites. There, that is no place for these toxic wastes. What you need to understand, and what your listeners, I think, need to understand, is that these toxic substances do not break down in the environment from something that's harmful into something that's benign or not harmful. And so any solution for storage needs to be forever, because these wastes, as long as they exist near our groundwater or rivers, they're always going to be a problem. They're going to present a problem.
All right, so then let me take this to you, Jen, and let me play you one more clip from a Georgia Power spokesperson, John Kraft, and he's talking about how they test for water quality.
We are conducting groundwater testing. We've put in wells around all of these ash ponds and continue to monitor. Even after they're closed, we'll continue to monitor groundwater, and we report those to the environmental agencies. We actually post them on our website, so all these testing results.
Jen, in your opinion, is Georgia Power planning to leave some of these sites that you think might, I guess, endanger the river?
Yeah, absolutely. So many of the sites, as Chris Bowers mentioned, will be left in place rather than excavated. And when we're talking about coal ash being left in place, we're talking about millions of tons of toxic coal ash mixed with water in an unlined facility. So it has the ability to just drain into our groundwater, and sometimes that groundwater bubbles back up to the surface water. So although Georgia Power is taking and excavating the ponds that are closest to the lakes, or closest to the rivers, oftentimes their intention is just to put that coal ash into another unlined pond. And in the Altamaha Basin, and that's Macon and Juliet and the coast, almost everywhere we've looked around these ponds, we have found leaks of toxic coal ash. And that includes people's drinking water wells.
So that sentiment was echoed by biologist Dennis Lemley. We spoke with him a while back about the dangers of coal ash. Here's what he said.
I've documented multiple times at multiple sites, along with many, many other researchers, that coal ash is a high hazard contaminant with respect to the health of fish and wildlife in the environment, and we have case after case after case to show that.
But Chris, many people, A, have never heard of coal ash, and B, assume that there are federal protections in place that are going to make sure nothing toxic gets into your water. Are they wrong about that?
Well, it took not only one, but two disasters in order for the EPA at the federal level to start taking a very, very close look. And afterward, it took several years for the final minimal federal protections to come into place in the form of regulations. And it's known as the CCR, or Coal Combustion Residuals Rule. And it finally seeks to address, at a minimal level, the three threats that these wastes pose. The first is fugitive dust, wafting through the air, getting into people's air that they breathe. The second is slow seepage, a percolating waste that seeps into the groundwater or seeps into a nearby open surface water. And the third is the catastrophic failure. Coal ash, if you look at it under a microscope, they're not little cubes that are a little bit more stable. They're actually little balls. And so it's inherently unstable. And when it's impacted by water, it can fail. So in 2008 in Tennessee,
fail meaning break apart into its composite, highly dangerous chemicals.
That's right. And actually just physically release. And so
right.
In 2008 at TVA's Kingston facility, 300 acres just released when a containment structure that was designed to hold back this waste ruptured suddenly right before Christmas.
Okay, so let's, Jen, let me play you one more comment from biologist Dennis Lemley. We spoke to him earlier this year. He's talking about the ideal way to contain this ash.
Well, as far as the ultimate solution, it's to encapsulate it in concrete. Even though it's moved to a lined landfill site, there are still issues, environmental issues, the most basic of which, liners leak, and it's well known that they leak. And we have many sites at lined landfills that have documented leakage into groundwater.
So, Jen, what are you asking for here? Are you asking for this ideal solution to put the coal ash into concrete?
I think at this point we're still a little bit unsure whether or not this beneficial reuse, this putting it and combining it in concrete, is the correct solution. But what we do understand is, yes, maybe these liners leak, but they're supposed to be intact for 500 years. And right now we have these toxic heavy metals leaking into people's drinking water wells. So we need to have this.
So you have your group. Your group, the Altamaha Riverkeeper Group, has documented liners leaking and it making into groundwater.
Our group, Altamaha Riverkeeper, has documented unlined ponds leaking into groundwater and drinking water. Right now, all 29 ponds across the state of Georgia are unlined. That means they have nothing to separate them from leaking through the soil and into the groundwater. So what we're looking for is a complete excavation of all 29 ponds and to have them placed in a lined and capped facility away from our waterways. If the long-term solution is to go ahead and put that coal ash into concrete or bind it in some way, it will be there in a lined and capped facility, not leaking, and they'll be able to reuse it at whatever time is best for the market.
Chris, what is, you're an attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center. What is the SELC asking for?
We want it to be in a modern lined landfill. Where it does not belong is directly adjacent to our rivers and streams and lakes. And
unlined.
That's where they currently are, yes.
Do we have the laws in place to force that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier...
We'll get right to you, Jen.
As I mentioned earlier, there is a minimum federal rule now. Unfortunately, that runs the risk of falling, being eroded and weakened at the federal level.
Jen, you say no, we don't have the laws that we need.
To force a utility to excavate the ponds, to my knowledge, there is no federal, there is no state law. We do have many of our legislators looking now at how is the best way to remove and dispose of this. They've introduced legislation last year and will be introducing legislation again this year at the state level. But we do not have any law to require our utilities to excavate these ponds.
So, Chris, do we have any idea how many people, the number of Georgians who live somewhere in a sort of danger area?
No, I can't. Sitting here today, I can't give you a population figure. Unfortunately, a lot of this waste exists in sparsely populated, more rural areas. And that goes into one of the things that we'd like to see strengthened in the laws is public notice and awareness. A lot of times, the public is not aware that they're living adjacent to some of these waste pits, and at a minimum, they should be aware, and so they can have a voice and speak up about their concerns.
And Jen, it makes logical sense that if some of this coal ash somehow makes it into groundwater, it could possibly end up being in a body of water that travels, right, for miles.
Oh, absolutely. And included in the dewatering process, when you're taking the water out of the pond, that will be treated and put directly into the water body that's next to the coal ash pond. So that has the ability to travel quite some distance.
Wait. When they are taking the water out of one of these ponds, they then dump that into the nearby water source?
Well, first they treat it. They go through a treatment
process,
and then they dump it into the lakes or rivers nearby, yeah.
Is the water, after it's treated, it's safe? Jen?
It is being tested for certain levels of heavy metal toxins, but there's no exceedance levels. So I'm unsure if I can answer that correctly, whether it's safe or not.
You think we don't know if it is safe?
I think it's pretty borderline. And no, we don't know for sure.
So when they were investigating the extent to which they should regulate this at the federal level,
yeah.
The EPA conducted very, very painstaking studies, hundreds of pages of scientific information. And what they concluded is that, a rule was necessary. Why? Because they documented sources of these waste streams that had traveled thousands of river miles downstream.
Thousands of miles.
That's correct. And that's from a study that was done by the EPA in order to recommend that more stringent requirements be imposed.
And what the SCLC is seeking legal remedies?
Well, there are other environmental groups at the federal level that have been that brought a suit in the D.C. Circuit in order to strengthen the federal rule. And then utility groups and energy companies have sued, saying it's too stringent. And so that is being played out in the courts currently.
That is Chris Bowers. He's senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center and also Jen Hilburn, head riverkeeper for the Altamaha River Group. It's a grassroots organization dedicated to the protection and restoration of Georgia's largest river. Chris and Jen, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Celeste.
Just ahead, an Atlanta cellist composes music for the movies. First, though, is there a profile for someone likely to commit sexual assault or rape? This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk about Southern identity. Some call it charm. Is it possibly passive-aggressive? We want to know what is the difference between the stereotypes and the truth. Are some of the stereotypes accurate? Find us on Facebook at OST Talk or call us 404-500-9457 and be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow. Now, we want to warn you the following conversation includes discussion of sexual issues and rape. It may not be suitable for all listeners. Use your discretion. Last year, at least 15 on-campus rapes were reported at the University of Georgia in Athens. And as a nation, we're having more very tough conversations about sexual violence and harassment as more women step forward to accuse powerful men of abusing their positions. We have profilers for killers and terrorists, but what about people who are likely to commit assault and rape? Is there a profile? Kevin Swartout is Associate Professor of Psychology and Public Health at Georgia State University. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Catherine Jungt, a sociologist with Emory University. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
So, Kevin, let's start about on the psychology of someone who might engage in a sexually abusive act. Why do so many mental health professionals say it's not about sex?
Well, it is about sex to a certain extent, but it's about a lot more than sex. We know that there are some factors that put men, especially young men, at higher risk for perpetrating sexual violence or sexual assault. Having a lot of impersonal sex is one of those factors. But another factor that's just as important, if not more important, is their levels of hostility toward women. The social networks they hang out with, are their peers supportive of sexual violence? Do their peers engage in sexual violence? And also there's a large substance use component to it. We know that alcohol use is involved in a majority of at least campus sexual assaults by either the victim, the perpetrator, or both. So there's a lot of factors, but it is, to a certain extent, about sex.
So, Catherine, part of the reason we have discussions like this is because we're trying to prevent it, right? How does a better understanding of someone who might engage in this kind of behavior, how does that help us prevent future assaults and harassment?
That's a great question, and I wanted to lend my support to the risk factors that our colleague mentioned. I also wanted to mention another important piece of this, and that is to recognize that the perpetration of sexual violence can also come from experiences of trauma and violence in childhood. And I think our research has borne out that sometimes high percentages of men are exposed to child maltreatment, interparental violence, peer bullying, gang violence, etc. And so prevention programs would do well to understand the potential trauma that men have been exposed to as a possible determinant. Another thing that I think is really important is to understand that men are often brought up with certain expectations of masculinity that include stoicism, strength, denial of illness, but also aggression as a commonly accepted element of men's identity. And so prevention programs also would do well to support positive, nonviolent masculinities on college campuses, really as a population-based measure to prevent sexual violence.
Kevin, is there a difference in age in terms of likelihood? We're saying men a lot in this because men are the most likely by far. That doesn't mean women are not also don't also do this, but men are most likely to do it. But is there an age at which a man is most likely to engage in abusive behavior like this? Is it the younger guys? Is guys in their middle age?
To your first point, women can perpetrate sexual violence. Men can be victims of sexual violence. We know that that does happen.
Yeah.
But absolutely, the overwhelming majority of sexual violence and sexual assault is male perpetrated with females as survivors. In terms of the development of sexually violent or assaultive behavior, we know a good amount about adolescence through early adulthood. Once we get into middle and late adulthood, the information we have gets a little bit spotty because a lot of our samples are high school and college samples. We do know that sexually violent behavior does start to manifest in some as early as 14, 15, 16 years old when they're in high school. What's interesting in my research, I find that the young men who are most likely to perpetrate sexual violence and even sexual assault in high school are not the group of guys who are more likely to perpetrate or most likely to perpetrate in college. A lot of guys who perpetrate in high school, once they move to that college environment, for whatever reason, we think it might be alcohol use or peer network factors, they're less likely to continue perpetration.
The
group of guys who's most likely to perpetrate in college, a series of risk factors hit in college, substance use, negative peers, which increases their risk.
Catherine, is there a particular kind of intervention that is more effective than others? And I'm thinking of things like many universities have started with college courses that teach consent issues, for example. Do we know if there are any that are particularly effective?
There are surprisingly few evidence-based interventions. However, there are some that have demonstrated effectiveness. There are programs that teach, again, positive social norms around masculinity that clarify what real consent means in terms of sexual relationships, and that really try to work with peer networks, as was just described, to promote what we call pro-social bystander behavior. So if an incident that one observes of sexual harassment or other forms of sexual violence is occurring, then men are really encouraged to stand up and speak out in favor of prevention.
How far does that go, though, Catherine? In other words, we've been hearing a lot from men who say they've witnessed at least some sexual harassment in the workplace. Does their speaking up in that situation maybe have an effect on the possibility that it may get worse than that?
I think in general, part of what these programs are trying to do is to really change the culture around sexual relationships and to change the culture around what we accept and we don't accept. And so these strategies really are population-based strategies to try to reach as many men as possible to engage in effective prevention and effective bystander behavior. So that's been the approach that has been supportive in terms of evidence in preventing both incidents of perpetration and pro-social bystander behavior.
You were nodding your head, Kevin, when she was talking about changing a culture. Is that a better strategy? When trying to change a whole culture seems more difficult than changing an individual. Why is it the culture the better strategy?
Yeah, like my colleague mentioned, there haven't been a whole lot of prevention programs that have demonstrated effectiveness in actually reducing perpetration rates. A lot of the prevention programs in the last couple of decades have focused on the individual level, trying to get individuals not to perpetrate.
On victims, telling them.
And there is one risk reduction for program for victims out of Canada that is effective, although teaching women not to get raped is somewhat problematic,
yeah.
But... you know, we at this point, we need to go with what works. So as Catherine said, the population-based strategies have shown some effectiveness, and it is more of a global approach. But in terms of changing the social norms, it's really interesting in this current dialogue that we're having. Some people find it uncomfortable that several men in Hollywood and in industry
Louis
are being
C.K.
called
and
out.
Harvey Weinstein,
for,
yeah.
Yeah, are getting called out. It's uncomfortable, but that's what it feels like when you change the social norm. So this ultimately, this accountability could help combat sexual harassment and sexual violence because it makes it less normative. There's more perceived sanctions, which we know is actually a protective factor for harassment and violence. If you know you're going to be called out, you're less likely to engage in the behavior.
Catherine, we only have 30 seconds left, and I hate to do this to you, but is there such a thing as rape culture, and are we in one?
There certainly is a thing such as rape culture, and that's part of the norm that that we're trying to change through effective, pro-social, behavioral promotion, and really promoting non-tolerance for non-consensual sex.
That's sociologist Catherine Yungt. She's at Emory University, and she's the Isa Griggs Candler Chair of Global Health. You also heard Kevin Swartout from Georgia State's Department of Psychology and Public Health. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Atlanta cellist Nick Ogawa, popularly known as Takanobu, does not play in an orchestra. He produces his own ensemble with loops and percussive sounds to create thick, intricate soundscapes. You might well think that would be great music for a movie, and you'd be right. He also writes music for film and TV. We caught up with Takanobu this summer.
Hey, I'm Takanobu, and I'm a cellist from Atlanta. I always wanted to be like, well, first I wanted to be like a rock star or something, but now I'm, accepting that I'm doing something a little bit more tame than that. But people would always say that my music sounded like something from a movie, which I didn't really think very much of until people started to ask me if they could use my songs in their videos or that kind of thing. And then I was just like, well, I might as well just start writing for that purpose.
My time of need, I was lost in the abyss. But then you pulled me out and you built me up, but only for a time before it all gave up.
I find that the sense of space is very different in live performance versus film. Like, in film, things can breathe a lot more. In a live performance, you don't want to lose the audience and have too much space. So it's kind of straddling those two different worlds. But it's a good way to think about music too, because it's, you can get locked into just always being entertaining all the time and not giving people a chance to reflect. I grew up playing music my whole life. My parents had me studying Suzuki violin when I was three, and then I studied classical music until I was about 18, and then just kind of got tired of the classical world and just wanted to branch out. And I love classical music, but I just didn't enjoy the orchestra structure and the audition processes, and just the clamoring for chair position wasn't my personality. I also just really like writing stuff, so to use the cello as a writing tool is kind of not classical, so I just branched away from it.
Mm-hmm.
first piece I discovered was this piece, Julio, by Mark Summer of the Turtle Island String Quartet. It just blew my mind because he was slapping the cello and doing all these kinds of like very guitar-y types of techniques that just sounded, you know, blew my mind when I heard it, because I was like, this is what I want a cello to sound like, or to, you know, at least be doing more far out things. And then I discovered looping, and I tried out a loop pedal at a guitar store and, you know, immediately bought it and kind of made that a primary part of my writing process. Cello is really conducive for that because it has so many different voices within it, because you can, you know, you can pizzicato backbone to things and then bowed harmony lines on top of it and then kind of weave stuff in and out of it and layer it, and that's what I do. Exposition is like a primo example of how I'm using the loop pedal, just to build up stuff and take it away and kind of make it a little crazy and then bring it back to earth again. Cello that I had in my car. Thought I'd bring it in, play a tune. So this is Shady Grove, old Appalachian folk song that I learned. This is the first song I learned how to sing and play at the same time.
Beaches in the summertime, apples in the fall.
That's Atlanta cello player and composer Takanobu. He performs at Eddie's Attic in Decatur this Sunday at 6 p.m. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We kind of need to hear from you on this, right? We'll talk tomorrow about Southern identity. What does it mean to be a Southerner for you? And do you think some of the stereotypes are true? Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.
I played on it. I wish that girl was mine. Shady Grove, my little love. Shady Grove, I know. Shady Grove, my little love. Bound for Shady Grove. I wish I had a needle and thread, fine as I could sew. I'd sew that pretty girl to my side, down the road I'd go. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove I know. Shady Grove.